I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
On this episode, we're going to talk with Dr. Hollis Carrilly. Hollis is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Colorado State University. And she's going to be talking to us about the cannabinoids that are commonly found in cannabis, with a focus on CBD and THC. Hollis, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
We are delighted to have you. This is a topic that I've been really interested in for a while. Curious about, you hear a lot about from the general public. So it'll be great to have a scientist's perspective. But before we jump into that, we always like to start with our guest's training history. So could you tell us a little bit about your training?
Yeah, so I graduated in 2018 from the clinical psychology PhD program at CU Boulder. And I initially, you know, I worked under the mentorship of Dr. Kent Hutchison, who at the time that I was, you know, searching for PhD programs, I knew I wanted to do clinical psychology, and I was really interested in alcohol research. I also was interested in sort of the biological aspects. So things like neuroimaging and genetics were really exciting to me at the time that I was, you know, kind of considering graduate programs. And so Dr. Hutchison at CU was basically at that time really known for his alcohol work. And he was doing a lot with neuroimaging and alcohol, as well as some genetics and epigenetics stuff. So really was like a fantastic fit for me. And I was, it just worked out perfectly for me to go to that program. One of the really interesting things that happened over the course of my time in graduate school in Boulder is that cannabis was legalized in Colorado. And so I started my training totally thinking I'm going to do alcohol research. I'm going to like probably do, you know, mostly neuroimaging, people who are, you know, report heavy drinking, study the effects of alcohol on reward systems in the brain using these, you know, imaging tools. But what happened during the time that I was in graduate school is that the landscape really changed, and everyone, all of the people who studied substance use and addiction, were having to grapple with this change in the landscape whereby the participants in our studies were using cannabis a lot and reporting that they were using it at a lot more than they did before, whether that's because, you know, because of the legalization or just sort of the general shift in attitude around cannabis. And so the researchers, we were sort of faced with this question of like, well, should we try to like screen out for people who use cannabis in our studies so we can just purely, you know, continue being alcohol researchers? Or do we actually think that there might be something, you know, interesting going on here regarding how cannabis use impacts all the things that we're interested in? And so over my time in graduate school, the cannabis focus really became a big part of the lab that I was in. You know, Kent's work now is probably as much known for being cannabis focused as it was alcohol focused when I first started with him. So he really kind of shifted what he was interested in during the time that I was training. And I also, over that time, sort of moved from being pretty much interested in, you know, purely alcohol research to being much more interested in the overlap of alcohol and cannabis. You know, co-use has kind of been my focus in the past few years, and, you know, studying the things that I think we're going to discuss today in more depth, the different cannabinoids, CBD, THC, acute effects, stuff like that.
Yeah, that's all really fascinating. I mean, I think we can get so pigeonholed into what we like want to do or what we expected to do. Sometimes we miss these huge opportunities. And I imagine your mentor, you know, when this all started happening, shifted. But I think that's a really important lesson, is to keep an eye out for all like the policy stuff that's going on, or the just the general zeitgeist. And as that changes, shift research as well. And I also noticed that you went from Boulder to Colorado Springs. So how long, you've been in Colorado for quite a while.
Yeah. Boulder to Fort Collins. I'm at Colorado State.
Oh, sorry. Right. Fort Collins.
In Fort Collins. And a big reason for that is that the work that I want to do now is very, I mean, it's not that easy to do it here, but it's definitely not easy to do it in other places where, you know, legalization either hasn't been around as long or where, you know, THC recreationally is not legal. Colorado is one of the few places in the country where the types of observational sort of naturalistic studies of legal market cannabis can actually happen. And we, you know, we can talk more about we're still affected by a lot of the like federal restrictions, research restrictions and stuff like that, but at least we can do some of the work we want to do here. So, you know, for me, it was important to be able to, you know, be somewhere where I could study the research questions that I want to ask.
Yeah, I think, you know, and we were talking a little bit about this before the show started, but right, the idea is do the research that only you can do, right? Mm-hmm. And so your work in this place makes so much sense, right? So you went to residency at the Medical University of South Carolina and then came back because of the unique landscape here, right?
Yep.
And so we know your research covers a wide array of mechanisms, including neural mechanisms, molecular, behavioral stuff, and the etiology of alcohol use disorder. And as you've alluded to, today we're hoping to focus on your work that characterizes the role of endogenous cannabinoids, kind of, which are distributed heavily throughout the brain and gut in your work in this space. And so this is pretty unique work that you do here. This is not something that I think you casually come upon in journals as much as maybe other things that we've talked about on the show. And so could you tell us a little bit just about like how you got interested in this whole brain and gut and cannabinoid space?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the first step was, like I already mentioned, like sort of being in the right place at the right time. Like when I was training and thinking about alcohol use disorders, this big shift in policy happened, and suddenly everyone wanted to do cannabis research in, you know, in the department that I was in. And so it was kind of a no-brainer, like, okay, alcohol and cannabis overlap. You know, this is something that people are getting interested in, not just in Colorado, but elsewhere. You know, it's something anecdotally, I was working as a clinician on a couple of different research studies, one of which involved alcohol, heavy drinkers who wanted to cut down on their alcohol use. And so I was getting all of this anecdotal kind of evidence or exposure from clients who would come in and talk about, you know, their cannabis use in conjunction with their alcohol use, and how cannabis use for them, either in some cases it made them want to drink more, in some cases it was, you know, they'd come in and say, hey, I didn't drink at all this week. And, you know, we would start talking about what they did during that week. And they would say, well, you know, Tuesday and Wednesday night, I popped an edible before bed. So I just, you know, drifted off to sleep and everything was great. And I didn't even think about drinking. Right. And certainly that was not every single person's response. There were also people that would come in and say, you know, man, I had a rough week this week. And I think part of it is that we got together and we smoked a couple nights, and it's hard for me to, you know, smoke socially and not also drink. So interesting. So how come for some people cannabis seems to increase alcohol use, and then for others it seems to act more like, you know, a substitute or something that can actually kind of serve this maybe like harm reduction purpose to try to reduce how much they're drinking. So I started to kind of make these connections from my clinical work. And during that same time, there was, you know, emerging literature coming out regarding this phenomenon where, you know, as the landscape of cannabis in the US changes, we're seeing evidence of substitution for cannabis and alcohol substitution, whereby increased cannabis use is associated with decreased drinking. And then we're also seeing studies where cannabis and alcohol seem to be sort of like complementary, and using one increases the other. So this just really fascinated me, like what's going on here? What are some of the moderating or, you know, the different factors that might impact this relationship? Does it depend on the person? Does it depend on the context? Maybe it depends on the cannabis. And so that was kind of where my initial interest in alcohol and cannabis co-use developed. I would say it started clinically for sure. And then, you know, digging into the literature, I just got more and more interested in it. And in the course of learning about this stuff, one of the things that stood out to me, I also have a neuroscience background. So my program at CU, I also did this sort of, I did this like dual clinical psych and neuroscience track. So I had taken a lot of courses, you know, focused on the brain. I had a bit of background in neuroimaging. And so I always sort of come at things from a somewhat biological perspective. And in the course of my reading about alcohol and cannabis co-use, one of the things I found really interesting is that the endogenous cannabinoid system, which is basically composed of some receptors and other molecules that are innate to our bodies and to which the cannabinoids from the cannabis plant actually bind, that system is heavily distributed throughout our guts. There's also a lot of anecdotal evidence from clients and patients who will say that they use cannabis to help with things like their appetite or things like symptoms of, you know, irritable bowel, IBS. So there's something going on with cannabis and the gut. Similarly, there's been a lot of research in recent years about how alcohol can disrupt the sort of bacterial milieu of the gut and cause a number of different sort of downstream negative effects, inflammation, like systemic inflammation, the leaky gut syndrome, which lots of people have probably heard of. It was kind of big in like the popular press a while ago. Alcohol is one of the things that can cause leaky gut. And so there have been these sort of two interesting but very separate literatures on alcohol in the gut and then cannabis in the gut. And as I looked into this stuff, I realized that no one has really merged these two. So there hasn't been a study where we look at, you know, the gut microbiome in folks who use both alcohol and cannabis compared to people who only drink or people who only use cannabis. And so that was something that I got really interested in. And then I ended up writing a K23 grant through NIAAA to basically do a somewhat smallish scale sort of first initial investigation into this topic. And so that's a big project that that I've, you know, just started working on now.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, because there's this cultural interaction, socio-political force that has changed the landscape of cannabis in Colorado and across the nation, sort of starting with Colorado a little while ago. And then inherent in that is this other interaction that you've described, is this alcohol and cannabis, specifically with the gut. But it, I mean, it's just such a complicated issue, like you said, that could be, it could be individual people, individual differences, either biological or, you know, contextual or whatever. But then it could also be cannabis. And from what I understand about cannabis is that cannabis is very, very different depending on what strain you're using, what cannabinoids are most active versus, you know, less active. And could you talk a little bit about all of the different, maybe not all the different cannabinoids that are, you know, at play in any strain of cannabis, but maybe some of the major players?
Yeah, so the cannabis plant basically contains over 100, probably well more than that, different cannabinoid compounds that we know of. I think the last time I checked, there was maybe like 120 of them, but this number is always increasing. And so the ones that you hear most about are of course, Delta-9 THC, which is the one that is psychoactive and is likely responsible for, you know, the euphoric sort of high that people report, you know, what people are looking for when they use cannabis recreationally. The other big one that's garnered a ton of attention recently is cannabidiol or CBD. And so CBD is not typically present at very high levels, very high concentrations in the cannabis that people use recreationally, especially if it's coming from like an illegal source, not from a legal market dispensary. Some of the legal market products now are including higher levels of CBD because there's been this big marketing push around, you know, touting the benefits of CBD, which I'm sure we'll get into momentarily here, but
Yes, please.
yeah. You know, so basically THC and CBD are the big ones. CBD is mostly thought to be non-intoxicating. Sometimes people do report feeling some sort of intoxicating effects from it, but it's not nearly as intoxicating as THC. It doesn't typically cause people to like feel high or feel euphoric. And what's super interesting about CBD and what's I think responsible for like a lot of the scientific interest in CBD is that it seems to have these incredibly widespread effects throughout the brain and body. It works on the immune system. So it binds to some receptors on immune cells and might have some interesting, you know, immune properties in the brain and body. We don't totally know how it works. We have a pretty good sense of what THC does in terms of its molecular effects. We know that it binds to CB1 and CB2, which are like the main receptors that are part of our endogenous cannabinoid system. But CBD actually doesn't have very high affinity for those receptors, and it does a whole bunch of other things in the body. So it's sort of this like really interesting, like unknown landscape of, you know, CBD seems to have these interesting effects, but what exactly does it do? We don't know yet. We're working on it. People are working on it. I want something I also think is important to mention, you know, when we're talking about CBD is that it's really been marketed in recent years as a treatment for like all kinds of conditions. So pain and inflammation and sleep and anxiety. And there's very little empirical research on any of this at this point. There is well-supported data for CBD as a treatment for childhood seizures. So there's a medication called Epidiolex, which is like a pure CBD solution. There's no THC in it. Works well for treating these intractable childhood seizures. So that's an awesome like advance related to CBD. That's really exciting. But I, you know, I always just, when I talk about CBD, I really want to emphasize that like, this is a very young field, and beyond this compelling childhood seizure data, most of the other work is still really in its kind of nascent stage.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, I mean, you hear so many things about CBD. I mean, I've heard a lot from lay pub, like, you know, like my friends, my family, my mom wanting to get it for my dog to help out with the anxiety, you know, it's, which is, I have no idea. It seems wild to me, a wild thing to do, but, you really just hear all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, no, I think part of the, what the scientists need to do is when it comes to this type of research is it's sort of an example of like, you know, let's all stay in our lanes and focus on the conditions that we have the capacity to study. Right. And so for me personally, I'm most interested in how cannabinoids impact alcohol use disorders. And so what's motivated my kind of my interest in CBD is how might it impact alcohol use? There were these three studies that were done. I think one was in like 1979 and then two were in 1980, or maybe two in 79 and one in 80. But essentially there were these three studies that were done 40 plus years ago, where they looked at how pre-treatment with CBD before an alcohol administration, like standardized dose of alcohol, oral alcohol, impacted blood alcohol level. And the studies had conflicting findings, right? Like one of them found no difference. I think one of them found like maybe a slight decrease in blood alcohol level when people were given CBD before they drank. But this is kind of interesting and nobody really followed up on it. In the past 40 years, there haven't been any other laboratory studies to my knowledge of CBD and alcohol. And What did happen is that a few years ago, some really interesting preclinical studies came out. And this is kind of where, this is really what has motivated a lot of my interest in the topic. So there's been these couple of rodent preclinical studies that show that in rodent models of alcohol use disorder, giving the mice or rats CBD actually reduces the amount of alcohol that they self-administer and also reduces some of the other classic behavioral markers of dependence that we see in these AUD rodent models. So this, I mean, in my opinion, we need to follow up on some of this stuff in humans. And that's kind of, you know, that's the state of where CBD and alcohol research is at. There's a couple of large-scale clinical trials now ongoing for CBD in alcohol use, you know, individuals who have alcohol use disorders and want to cut down on their drinking. In my lab, I'm doing a small laboratory study where we're giving people different doses of CBD prior to a standard alcohol administration paradigm. And then we're measuring things like intoxication and BAC over like the next 4 hours, so we can sort of capture what's going on, you know, over the rise and fall of the blood alcohol curve. So kind of trying to harken back to some of those 1980s, 70s and 80s studies. But yeah, in my small sphere of CBD and alcohol research, that's sort of where we're at. And it's, like I said, things are at the very, very beginning stages. And I think that's true in other areas of CBD research as well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, right? Like if you just look at the chronology of some of these studies and some of this work, right? Like you talk about some stuff that happened in like 40 years ago, mm-hmm. and then a couple of studies that happened a few years ago, and this like just expanse of time, yeah. right? And part of that is, I'm sure, due to like specific and systematic barriers that exist for this kind of work. And so I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about what are the kinds of barriers for this kind of work that you have to deal with just like on a day-to-day trying to answer some of these questions about AUD, let alone for us to try and get answers about glaucoma or hot dog fingers or whatever those other conditions that you hear on these advertisements related to CBD or THC for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, the barriers are greater when it comes to cannabis containing THC. So maybe I'll start there. So, you know, as a Schedule I drug, which cannabis is currently scheduled under Schedule I, basically the only federally legal source of cannabis for research historically in the US has been the NIDA drug supply program. So basically, if you want to use some cannabis, you have to buy these specific products that were grown at this NIDA farm. And you'd need to get a DEA license to bring them to your lab on campus, which is definitely, you know, it doesn't make it impossible, but it is a sort of an added layer of difficulty for the researchers. But the real problem with this cannabis was that it historically contained very, very low amounts of THC. So, you know, there are studies where there's like 1.6% THC or 3% or even like 5 or 6%, right? But the cannabis that people use, so if you go into a dispensary in Colorado or Oregon or California, you know, and you buy a popular strain of cannabis flower that you're going to smoke, it contains more like 20% THC, maybe even upwards of 25% THC. So the products that were available through the NIDA drug supply program and that were tested in the prior studies don't really replicate like what people are actually using. And more recently, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, has said that it will actually issue some licenses to, well, actually, let me back up. So the NIDA farm has increasingly, they have a wider array of products, but they still don't have cannabis that like is 20% THC. I think maybe they have some 10% strains or something like that, which is better, but it's still not exactly, it's not really the same drug that people are using. So that's a major barrier. More recently, something really exciting happened, and the DEA said that they would start issuing licenses to some US cannabis growers that could start to produce and supply more diverse products to medical researchers. So that's really cool. It's really promising. I think it's going to help move our field along a lot. As far as I know, you know, at this point, this process has really only recently started. And the full sort of like menu of options doesn't seem to be available yet. So like one of my recent interests has been in high potency cannabis called concentrates, which are these really, really concentrated forms of cannabis that people usually smoke through like a vaporizer, like those little pens that you've maybe seen people using. And those can be up to like 90 to 95% THC. So as far as I know, these growers are not offering products like that. I don't know whether they have edibles available, but edibles are really popular on the market here in Colorado. And we don't know a ton about how they work and how they might impact things like co-administration with alcohol. So Yeah, so in this regulatory landscape has limited the type of research that we could do in the US historically, and it's still placing some limits on folks like myself and others in Colorado and other legal market states who want to study the products that people are using, not these, like, you know, slightly less potent, or in some cases very much less potent products that have been, you know, more historically available for medical research. So those are some of the barriers.
Just a few.
Yeah, just a right. couple.
Yeah, no big. Right. And also, I think sounds like, from what you're describing, that a lot of the stuff that we've come to know about cannabis in popular media is a little cart before the horse, right? That people are making claims about it that we just don't know, because the work can't actually be done as it's currently, as the structures currently exist in the US.
Right. And people have had to find ways to circumvent the rules. One that, you know, a lot of people may know about is the method that was developed by, you know, my graduate and postdoc mentors at CU. So Kent Hutchison, Angela Bryan, Cinnamon Bidwell came up with this mobile laboratory approach where they would actually take people, they would, you know, people could go to the dispensary, pick up a particular product, and they would show up with this mobile lab that was outfitted with, like, you know, a blood draw station and a bunch of iPads and laptops and stuff to do intoxication measurements. And so folks could go into their house, use their cannabis product, tell us exactly what they used. So, you know, take a picture of what the product label was so that they would know exactly how much THC was in it. They could, like, weigh it before and after using it to get an estimate of how much they actually used in the session. And then they come out to this van, essentially like a white Scooby-Doo style van that's parked in the person's driveway or in front of their home, and get their blood drawn to measure how much THC is in their blood, as a way to try to quantify how much they used. It would be much easier if we could just tell them how much to use, but of course we can't do that because of the federal regulations. But then in the mobile lab, they can, like, do a bunch of tests of psychomotor impairment, cognitive impairment, subjective feelings of intoxication, stuff like that. So this is one way that people have been circumventing the rules. That, you know, I've definitely heard of really creative researchers from other institutions who have kind of come up with other different ideas of how they could study people's legal market cannabis consumption patterns and habits. But none of these ways really are as good as if we could get the products, bring people to our lab, administer them and assign them in a tightly controlled way, the way that we do all of our other laboratory research. We're just really limited by the federal restrictions right now.
Yeah, well, I think we talked about this with Alan Budney a little while ago, but even the concentrations that are in TH or that are in the cannabis products on the legal market, we're not 100% sure that they've been regulated correctly, right? So I think that in general, I mean, I hear what you're saying, and to take it even a step further, the legalization and regulation, so that actually the legal, you know, the legal free market that actually is out there, can when we do study it, that it actually represents, you know, what we think it's representing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. I would agree. I would agree with all of that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's some interesting work out there. I think it's Krista Listall maybe have done did a study where they looked at, like, the label versus if they tested it molecularly to see, like, how much they match, and they were, like, all over the map and stuff. And so it does seem like one of the only ways is, or I guess there's a couple of paths, right? Like, one is that NIDA or something like that, like, gets their cannabis grow operation to the levels, right? But another one is to pair a little bit with some of the cannabis industry, because there are some really high-tech operations happening, especially in Colorado, to help us kind of get a little bit more precision in understanding what cannabinoids are on board for the products.
Yep. Yeah, and my experience has been that at least with some of the industry folks that I've, you know, been able to connect with in Colorado, a lot of these companies are really interested in doing this work. Like, they want to work with researchers. We've had a couple of companies that have come to us and asked us to do a pharmacokinetic study on their products. So look at, you know, people's, draw people's blood a whole bunch of times after they use like an edible or concentrate or something and map out the THC levels. You know, so that would be sort of more like the, on our end, what could we do? But also many of these companies, they do want to validate their products. They do want to be able to say, tell their consumers, this is exactly what's in our products. They're safe. We've done everything we can do. But there's just the infrastructure feels like it's not totally there yet to actually make this, you know, sort of dream a reality. And then I also would imagine that there's probably other companies where safety and pharmacokinetic studies are probably not a top priority for them. So it's that's an issue too, for sure, a safety issue.
Yeah, there's a lot of different players all with their own agenda.
Right.
And I think that's probably an important kind of like aerial view message on the landscape of cannabis research today, is that depending on who you're listening to, they have a different agenda for what they're doing, which is why we need more empirical work like yours to be done. Funders, if you're listening, God, that would be really nice if they actually listened to the show. I don't know if that's true, but if they do, if they were listening, right, these are one of those types of things where we need to be able to get some of this work through.
Yeah, absolutely.
So could you tell us a little bit about like what's on the horizon for you? On the work that you're doing, and maybe what still needs to be done in the space. It sounds like there's a lot of unanswered questions. What are your plans for the future here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's so many avenues that a cannabis researcher, especially in a legal market state like Colorado, could potentially pursue. It's a bit overwhelming, you know, thinking of all the options. But for me, again, I try to kind of, at least at this point in my career, I'm a, you know, newly an assistant professor, so I'm trying to stay focused. And what I feel most passionate about is, you know, cannabis and alcohol and that relationship and disentangling sort of like what aspects of cannabis might impact alcohol consumption and, you know, exploring different relationships between different types of cannabis and alcohol and looking at things like blood alcohol level following cannabis consumption, kind of these broad questions that maybe seem really simple, but we actually don't. We've never done the studies to answer them, at least not with legal market cannabis. And so I have a few projects going on right now. One, like I mentioned, is the CBD and alcohol study that's similar to those, you know, historical studies from 40 years ago, where we're just testing different doses of CBD and how it impacts blood alcohol level and intoxication after people drink a standard dose of alcohol. So that's, you know, the laboratory work on CBD feels really relevant to me, at least in the context of CBD and alcohol co-use. I'm also, I was lucky enough to be able to sort of replicate the mobile laboratory setup here at Colorado State, similar to the one that all of my mentors developed at CU Boulder. But in my lab, my mobile lab specifically is an alcohol and cannabis co-use lab. So, you know, I have a study where a mobile laboratory study going where folks will use flower cannabis in their homes and then come out to our lab and do a sort of an alcohol self-administration paradigm. And we're interested in how much they drink after they use cannabis compared to how much they drink at another session where they don't use cannabis. We've got another project going on that's very similar to that project, but where people are using cannabis concentrates in their house, and then they're coming out into our lab and drinking a standard dose of alcohol, so that then we're standardizing the alcohol dose, and that means that we're able to measure a bunch of intoxication outcomes and kind of compare how different concentrates combined with alcohol impact intoxication over time. You know, I'm also interested, like I said, in the microbiome, the gut microbiome. So in some of my work, we collect these fecal samples from our subjects, and we're able to actually sequence the microbiome, the genetic material of the bacteria living in their guts. So we can sort of, you know, compare the gut microbiome across people who use alcohol and cannabis, or maybe people who just use alcohol or just use cannabis. But there's, you know, there's a ton to be done in this space of alcohol and cannabis co-use. And so my challenge now is kind of figuring out, like, what are the most important questions? What are the questions that, you know, you mentioned, Noah, answer the questions you can answer. So what are the questions I'm most well positioned to answer in this space? And how can I figure out a way to support myself in, you know, doing that work and doing that research?
Yeah, I think the interaction between alcohol use and cannabis use in this space is particularly important, right? Like, one is the idea that, like, when their powers combine in your gut, like, what does it do to you? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, is one, but also this idea that they kind of might have offset for, you know, alcohol use or alcohol use disorder, I think is particularly important. And at least the question that I know people really are interested in the answer to. Mm-hmm. Do you know if there's any work, and I understand you're probably going to speak off the cuff, but do you know if any work, I know anecdotally in clinical work I've done where people have talked about craving, mm-hmm. getting moderated by CBD administration or other cannabinoids for alcohol use or for cannabis use. Do you know of any work that's being done in that space or any answers that we might have to that?
Well, you know, I think the best answers are probably at this point only at the preclinical stage. So I'll go back to those really interesting mouse and rat studies where, you know, you can't ask a mouse or a rat if they're experiencing craving, right? It would be super cool if we could. I wish. But based on—
Also, you know, a barrier.
Yes, yeah. That's a barrier. I don't think we can fix that one.
No, that one's not, I don't think we can get overcome that.
You know, but there are these like classic markers of dependence that we see in rodent models. And in those studies where they gave the mice and the rats CBD, these, you know, AUD mice and rats CBD, they showed reductions in those markers. And so, like, that's, to me, that's the compelling stuff we need to follow up on in human subjects. So I don't know, in my study, I'm asking them about craving. So
nice.
Wait for my analyses to be done, and maybe I can tell you
We'll have to circle back and have you come.
We'll circle back. Yeah, but yeah, no. I mean, I think anecdotally, people definitely report that. And like I said, there are some large scale trials going on. So we, you know, and that's the gold standard, right? Like, if these trials show that CBD helps people to drink less, like, that's huge, and that's good evidence that we can, you know, then clinically we might be more comfortable engaging when people say, oh, CBD helps reduce my craving for alcohol. Like, right now, if our client came to us and told us that, we wouldn't have much to offer them from science. But I think in time, hopefully, we will really have data that we can draw on, so we're not just having to speak, you know, from our anecdotal experience.
Agreed. Well, Hollis, it's been super awesome having you on. We'd like to transition next to our take-home messages, if that's all right.
Sure.
So the first one that we have is, what do you think a take-home messages are from your work or from our discussion here for consumers who are considering using CBD or recreational cannabis products?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to give you a long answer here. I know these are supposed to be short answers. I'm going to give you a long one here.
Totally fine.
Because it's important, I think. So one thing that I really want to emphasize for anyone who's thinking about using CBD for any reason is that you can go anywhere. You can go to a gas station, you can go to your gym or your coffee shop or your, you know, grocery store, and you can buy something that says on the label that it's CBD. But CBD is not regulated by the FDA. Anytime you buy a CBD product, you run the risk that the product has different amounts of CBD than what's stated on the label. It could also contain no CBD at all. So it could be completely inert and you're just wasting your money on something that doesn't actually have CBD in it. You know, these products also carry the risk of contamination. You know, this is a risk that we run when we buy certain types of products, you know, supplements and stuff like that. But, you know, if somebody's really interested in using CBD to treat a health condition, one thing that they need to do, in addition to being aware that like the products they buy may not have CBD in them, is they should talk to their doctor. One thing that most people don't know is that there are some medications like blood thinners and a couple of other meds that CBD actually has negative interactions with. So don't just go out and decide that you're gonna, you know, self-treat whatever ailment you have with CBD. I would strongly recommend speaking to your doctor about it first. And your doctor may not know the answer. And if that's the case, you know, I would probably recommend erring on the side of caution, because the research isn't there to support CBD for most of the conditions that people are out, you know, are out there that CBD is being marketed for. So another thing to keep in mind about the CBD that you might buy from like the grocery store, or the gym or something like that, is that most of the time the doses that are available are really low. So, you know, you might pay, I don't know, $6 for like a protein. I'm just guessing here what they have at your store or your gym, maybe $5-$6 for like a protein bar or a shake or something that has 10 or 20 milligrams of CBD in it. And I mentioned that there are some clinical trials that have been done of CBD, and those typically, the doses that they use typically start somewhere more around like 200 milligrams would be sort of a low pharmaceutical dose of CBD. Some of the trials, you know, will be administering CBD up to 1800 milligrams. And so, you know, again, I don't have the data to say this with 100% confidence, but I would suspect that buying 20 milligrams of CBD in like a smoothie or a powder or something like that, it's probably, even if there is 20 milligrams of CBD in it, it may not have a whole lot of biological effect. And so if nothing else, I worry about the consumers just wasting money because we don't have good dosing information. Wow. And when we look to the, you know, the pharmaceutical doses and the stuff that's being run in these trials, usually they use much bigger doses. So another thing to just keep in mind about CBD. In terms of, you know, THC, on the THC side, we kind of already hit on this, but it's the same issue. It's even if you go into a dispensary, you may feel like, you know, I'm buying a product that I look here on the label and it says it's X percent THC and X percent CBD, and that's great. And I feel super safe because, you know, the person in the dispensary told me what the product would do and how I would feel when I used it. But like I believe Sam mentioned, it's not always the case that these products contain what they say that they contain. Sometimes they do, but you're not going to be 100% sure because of the lack of regulation of the products. So the old like adage that is used in sort of the medical cannabis, you know, this burgeoning like medical cannabis, legal market cannabis world, is to tell folks if they are going to use cannabis, THC containing cannabis in particular, if they are going to use it to try to, you know, treat what ails them, start with a low dose, start low and go slow. Start with the lowest dose you can possibly get your hands on and see how that affects you. If you feel like you want to have a little bit more, you know, slowly increase your dose. But we definitely, you know, don't want people to take too much of a product, because that's how you get people, you know, having a really, really terrible experience, maybe, you know, going to the ER with, you know, all kinds of unpleasant symptoms and, you know, potentially just having a very negative experience. So starting with a low dose and seeing how it affects you before you use more.
Those are all, those are all really, really good recommendations. I personally haven't thought much about how they could just put whatever they want into the product. I've always thought that like, oh, maybe the level wouldn't be accurate. Maybe there'll be more THC or less THC or more CBD or less, but to think that it maybe is just something completely different or nothing.
Yeah.
It's a little frightening. what would you have to say to practitioners?
Yeah, I mean, I think for practitioners, you know, especially psychologists or, you know, therapists who might be working with individuals who have questions about like, how could CBD help me with my anxiety, or, you know, could cannabis help me to drink less or manage my pain? I think what we all really need to be responsible and remember is that the marketing efforts of these products have gone way, way, way beyond the research. And so the information that our clients might be bringing to us is probably not, you know, it's probably not based on research. And so we don't necessarily want to just kind of encourage them to explore those sorts of things without being very clear with them that there's not any empirical basis, right? If like your friend said that CBD helped with their anxiety, I can't go to the literature and find 10 papers to support that the way that I could if you know, your friend said that mindfulness helped with their anxiety. And so it's, you know, we're just not in a place where we can make those kinds of recommendations. We need this solid empirical data before we can really feel good about making recommendations to our client one way or the other. Sure, use THC to help with your sleep or use CBD to help with your alcohol use. Like, we're not there yet scientifically. And so we got to be up. I think we need to be really upfront about that as practitioners.
Completely agree. We just got to be able to have intelligent conversations about what we know. And unfortunately right now, we don't know, how much we don't know far surpasses what we do know. Yeah. And part of that is because of the barriers that you talked about to this types of work. And so I'm curious on what your take home message would be to policymakers.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think from a policy perspective, what needs to happen is we need to reduce the barriers, right? So this DEA, the thing where they are approving more growers to provide products for medical research, like that's a cool step. And I think that like that, as I said, is going to move things forward. But we probably are going to need more than that, right? If there wasn't a federal restriction, if cannabis wasn't illegal at the federal level, this would remove a lot of the barriers for researchers. That's probably more than we can get into today in our last few minutes, but that would be a huge thing that would change the landscape of research for us. You know, making it easier for investigators to conduct CBD and THC research on campus. This would really speed the research process. It would allow us to start actually being able to have evidence to support or refute these, you know, somewhat wild marketing claims that we all see, especially about CBD, but also about just cannabis more generally. The people of the world are interested in this stuff, and we can't answer their questions until we can do the science. And so if the policymakers were interested in supporting our science, I think that, you know, these would be the changes that would have to happen. The federal restrictions would need to be different.
Yeah. Yeah. What would your take home messages be for underserved populations?
Well, one thing that is really important to point out is that prior research in this area, I mean, not only is it just generally limited, the research in this area is generally limited by all the things we've been talking about over the last hour, but it's really not done a good job of including study participants and individuals from underserved populations. So, you know, I don't need to tell you all that biomedical research in general has historically underrepresented, you know, communities of color especially. And so it's really up to the researchers now to work on improving inclusion and equity in cannabis research specifically and in biomedical research more generally. I think some ways that we might do this would be, you know, things like implementing more inclusive recruitment strategies, right? Prioritizing community engaged recruitment. Also, you know, researchers need to be really clear and open about how they report on the demographics of their studies when they write papers. Journals and funding agencies need to hold researchers to a higher standard in terms of expectations that, you know, we have inclusive, diverse samples in our studies. It's up to the researchers to fix this problem of a lack of representation in our work to date, because it's a huge limitation of the work that's out there.
Well said. Yeah, I think, right. And there's been historical atrocities that mm-hmm. have underserved populations, communities of color specifically, are distrustful of the, you know, medical industrial complex that, or the academic medical structures that exist. And so a lot of work needs to be done to forge relationship with those communities, to work in their interests in addition to answering the scientific questions, and to ensure, there's good reason to be skeptical also because, individuals of color have historically been incarcerated at great rates compared to, majority population. And so coming into research and telling us that you're using cannabis sounds super fucking sketchy. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's a lot of work to be done here. And so I think your point is like a really important one, and I'm really glad you brought it up. So our last question is, you've been really successful in your career. What advice you got for the trainees out there who are listening?
Yeah, I think I would say if I had to pick one most important thing to tell trainees, it's that you should never be in a situation where you feel like you're doing your work alone. The kind of work that we're doing, the stuff we've been talking about over the last hour, these are big issues. Nobody's going to solve them by themselves. And science in general is a team effort. Maybe it hasn't always been that way, but going forward, I think science is becoming even more and more of a team effort. And so, it's hard. The work that you're going to do in your career is hard work. And so you should surround yourself with people that support you and people that you want to work with. I think like having a team that you really like and that you work well with, it makes all the difference. At least, for me, I feel like that's 100% what has helped me to kind of accomplish the things I've accomplished so far. And that's what makes doing this work fun, is working with great people. So find yourself a really good team.
Thanks, Hollis.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, such an important message, right? Like, we work in these spaces that are just surrounded with all kinds of different people. Find the people, right, that make sense for you is the key. Make the hard work as enjoyable as possible, right? And that's really the key. And I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you so much, Hollis. This has been absolutely fabulous. Lucky to have you on. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you.
Next time on The Addiction Psychologist, Dr. Robert Miranda will join us. Robert is a professor of psychiatry and human behavior in the Warren Alpert Medical School, professor of behavioral and social sciences in the School of Public Health, and the training director for the NIAAA NIDA-funded postdoctoral fellowship at the Center for Alcohol and Addiction Studies, all at Brown University. He's also the clinical director of the VISTA Intensive Outpatient Program at Bradley Children's Hospital, a Brown teaching hospital. He'll be talking to us about his research on medications for substance use disorder in adolescents and his work developing therapies. You won't want to miss this.